5 p.m., Keeping the Faith with Steve Shoemaker is next.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Welcome to Keeping the Faith. We're going to be talking this afternoon about Muslim neighbors. And we have two guests with us from the Intercultural Friendship Foundation, IFF. But before we get to our guests who are in the studio with us today and talk about neighbors, and let me say a word about our technical director. This is his last Sunday helping us here on Keeping the Faith. Brett Polson has been on this task for almost up to 6 years, and we're going to be missing him as he leaves. He came to WILL from Southern Illinois University, where he has a bachelor's in communication, specializing in radio TV. And he's been the technical director here for this program and is the welcoming voice you hear if you've ever called in, as well as handling all the dials here for the program that I know nothing about, and at the same time handling the FM programs on Sundays. So we're really going to miss Brett Polson as he moves on to other endeavors. He has a few more days here this week, but this will be his last Sunday helping out on Keeping the Faith. So we do thank Brett for his great work over the many years and many different guests and sometimes long-distance phone calls like last week to the West Bank of Palestine. And so he's handled many, many issues very well. Well, let's get into our talk about being neighbors. First of all, our first guest is the vice president of IFF, and that's Aziz Yoldashev. Welcome, Aziz.
Thank you.
Aziz is from Uzbekistan and is a graduate student here at the University of Illinois studying English as a second language. And our second guest is one of the core folks at the Intercultural Friendship Foundation, Melikan Tanyeri. He's a postdoctorate in physics, and you're from Turkey, right?
Yep.
And Melikan, tell us a little bit, not too much, but a little bit about what you do in physics.
I'm working with Professor Selvin at physics department, working on motor proteins. And there are nanometer-sized small cargo carriers in the cell called motor proteins. So I work the biophysics, physical properties of those motor proteins.
So this is biophysics, right? Things in human cells.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And where did you get your doctorate?
At the University of California, Davis.
At Davis. And where had you studied before that?
Before that, I had my bachelor's degree in physics in Istanbul, Turkey, at Bosphorus University, which used to be Roberts College.
I see. And that's a beautiful setting there in Istanbul. I've been fortunate enough to see it.
Yeah, it is.
Well, welcome to the program. Now, why is IFF this organization here at the University of Illinois that encourages dialogue and communication between various religious groups that's made up mostly of Muslims? Why is this group interested in exploring the idea of neighbors?
Well, let me try to answer this question.
Sure, Aziz.
To start off, neighbors in general, they hold a special status in Islam. Islam in general encourages Muslims to treat their neighbors in a special way, and not just in a tolerant way, but in a very friendly way, which is something that can be seen from a lot of sayings by the Prophet, peace be upon him, and the Prophet and those who were around him. And from those sayings, I mean, there are a lot of different aspects that can be learned about the way Muslims are expected to treat their neighbors. For example, there is one According to the prophetic tradition, Aisha, the wife of the prophet, peace be upon him, once asked him that she had two neighbors, and she asked him who she should send gifts to. And in an answer to this question, he replied, to the one whose gate is nearer to you. And he didn't mention, you know, that she should base her judgment, you know, based on the religion of the neighbor. It was based on, you know, the proximity. And so it is expected of Muslims to treat their neighbors, whether they are Muslim or non-Muslim, in a very friendly and very tolerant way, which I think is something that we kind of focus on, and we try to do it as much as we can in a lot of our activities.
It's interesting to me that in that example from the prophetic tradition in Islam, that what is expected is something active. It's not
right.
just we put up with you,
right.
But we sort of ignore you, but it's give a present to
right,
you.
Right. So it's not just saying hello, for example, or asking how they're doing. It's being active and sending gifts to them, or I don't know, share from other examples, from other sayings from the prophetic traditions. We can see that Muslims are also encouraged to share their meals with their neighbors. So it's, you know, there are, as you said, being active is something that is that you can see in a lot of these examples.
It's interesting as I look at my own religious tradition, which is Christianity, that it could be interpreted to be not quite that positive. For example, the most basic ethical rule in Christianity is do to others as you'd like them to do to you.
Right.
And you could say, well, I'd really like them to leave me alone, so I'll just leave them alone. So it doesn't necessarily, at least that rule, that golden rule for Christianity, there are other places in Christianity where Christians are told to reach out and to be positive and to feed the hungry and share. But it's interesting that rule, at least, if that's all the people looked at, could be seen as not necessarily always positive.
Okay. Well, there is something. Well, you referred to this statement as a rule, and something that I would say is that guides a lot of the actions toward Muslims is another saying by the Prophet, peace be upon him, in which he said that a man is not a believer till his neighbor is safe from harmful behavior on his part.
Oh.
And so, and there are, you know, there are examples where people, they would practice religion, they would do a lot of extra efforts to be pious, but just because they would not be treating their neighbors as they were expected to, they were not seen as people who would then enter the paradise because of the way because of how badly they would treat their neighbors. So this aspect is really one of the major aspects in being a true believer.
One of the biggest problems in inter-religious conversations is that people often judge the other person's religion by the worst actors, and they judge their own by the ideal. And I'm thinking that there may be some listeners at this point who are tempted to say, ah, well, if this is how Muslims are supposed to treat their neighbors, why do some Muslims be violent towards Christians and Jews and others? How do you respond to that? Melikan, you've got the PhD. You start on that.
Well, I think I got the PhD in the wrong field. But I would say there are always, you know, good examples and bad examples. You know, a person could be, you know, could claim himself as a good, you know, good Muslim. But as is stated, if he's not a good neighbor, in that sense, he's, you know, he's not acting on his beliefs, basically. So I would say if you know, I'm accused of something like that, I would basically say, you know, there are always good examples and bad examples, and those who are hateful or violent against fellow human beings, they cannot be true representatives of the religion, basically.
And Aziz, would you like to respond to that same very difficult question?
Yeah, it is very difficult. And I mean, especially if you think about ways to really, get the true message to people and show how we are actually expected to behave and how we actually should behave, which is something that we try to do as IFF and something that we, you know, try to think about as we, you know, develop different programs to engage the community here in Urbana-Champaign more in understanding not just each other's religions, but also each other's cultures and to interact more. Because, I mean, it's not just about the difference in religions. I mean, there are a lot of factors, of course, that come into play. As you said, it's really a difficult question to address.
IFF, the Intercultural Friendship Foundation that you two are leaders in, has a specific program to try and encourage people to cross religious boundaries and have dinner together. I want to ask you about that, but let me, since we're about 10 minutes into our program, let me get the phone numbers because we may have callers who want to also join this conversation. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 will bring you to our studio, and Brett Polson will answer the phone and put you in a line to talk to us here. If you're long distance, do call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. So, long distance, even if you're listening via computer, 1-800-222-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, several lines at 333-9455. And I see we have a call already on line number one. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was wondering you seem to be saying that there are prescriptions for Muslims to deal with neighbors in general. And in my reading of the Quran, I didn't see that. And I wonder if it's not more of a cultural thing that has arisen after the book, and if it's not different throughout the far-flung reaches of the Muslim world.
There are four sources of knowledge in Islam, basically, and Quran is one of them. The Holy Book is one of them. Another important aspect of the religion comes from the prophetic tradition. That means the actions and the sayings of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And what Aziz has just mentioned was a saying of the Prophet Muhammad. So it is not directly from Quran itself, but it is from the prophetic tradition and the actions of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
And how would someone who's interested in learning about Islam, where do you find that reference? I just went straight to the Quran and had been reading that.
That's a very good start, actually, to start with the translation of a Quran. And I think I would recommend, that's what people say, you know, for starters, it would be good to start from the end, from the short chapters of Quran and read from, you know, kind of from backwards to forward.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because at the end of Quran, there are short chapters which summarize most of the teachings in a concise way, and the previous chapters are longer and more detail.
And some Islamic scholars suggest that perhaps, I know this is debatable, but perhaps there's a bit of progression within the Quran itself, and at the end, it's more as an outsider, I shouldn't say, but I've read some interpreters who say if there's disagreement within the Quran, the latter portions is where you should come down.
Yeah. So in some sense, it's right. For the caller, I would like to finish
and then please come
back to your point. Yeah. Starting from the translation of the Quran is good, and then you can move on to the teachings of the Prophet, which are called hadith. You can look
spell
for,
that for us.
Yeah, you can spell for H-A-D-I-T-H.
Yes.
Hadith.
Sometimes it may be spelled a little differently.
Right.
H-A-D-E-E-T-H. But hadith is the accounts from the Prophet's life.
And where can listeners or this caller find those teachings?
Yeah. Anyone can search for it on the web and reach, to what's called Kutub al-Sitta, which is the six books, and the six scholars put out books of the prophetic tradition.
And these are translated into English?
Yes, they are available in English. Okay. So I think after translation of Quran, they can move on to hadith.
You said there were a total of four sources of knowledge. What are the other? What are three and four?
Yeah, the three and four is one of them is called Ijma, and that's basically the interpretations of the scholars after coming after Prophet Muhammad, basically.
Spell that word for us.
That's I-C-M-A, but that's in Turkish, so I'm not quite sure. I would say I-J-M-A, maybe Ijma. It's like I-J-M-A.
This would be the...
But that's more scholarly. It would be hard for anyone to reach, search for Ijma and find out that. So basically the first two sources are the main sources, Quran and Hadith.
And Hadith.
Hadith.
But just for our information, the fourth source?
Fourth source is the Qiyas, which means comparison. You basically compare the teachings and the actions of the Prophet to the daily life actions. For example, what's the place of internet or in religion, for example. So you basically compare the old, teachings with the modern concepts and try to come up with an answer.
Contemporary issues. Mm-hmm. Caller, did you want to follow up on that?
No. Well, it's I think this is very valuable because it's like if someone who had no Christian tradition and just sat down and started reading the Old Testament.
Or the Book of Revelation.
Yeah, you could be very puzzled. But the Quran is quite readable. I have a translation that's not very old that I got at the Champaign Library. And the first part of it, to me, reads almost like, but it's God's words. I understand speaking to the prophet, right? And it reads like that he's trying to convince. So it's like almost sermons.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I wanted to mention is tafsir, which usually it's a document that consists of the Quran and explanations of the Quran through. Very often through the through hadith, through prophetic tradition. So this is where you get Quran and hadith together.
Spell that word for us.
Tafsir. I would spell it in two ways. The first is T A F S I R, or T A F S E E R.
Yeah.
Tafsir. A lot of, as you said, there are a lot of that it sounds that it's sermon-like. You know that the God is almost persuading Muhammad, peace be upon him, and a lot of the surahs they're highly contextualized, and some of them came as a response to the questions that people of that time would ask from the Prophet, peace be upon him, for example, One example that I can think of is the people would keep asking the Prophet about the lineage of God, where God came from, who the family of God, And then, you know, the surah was revealed that the God is, قُلْ هُوَ اللَّهُ أَحَدٌ اللَّهُ الصَّمَدُ لَمْ يَلِدْ وَلَمْ يُولَدْ وَلَمْ يَكُنْ لَهُ كُفُوًا أَحَدٌ is the original.
Now you're quoting the Arabic there.
Yeah. And it basically means, say, well, it starts with قُلْ. قُلْ is like say, addressing the Prophet. Say that God is only one, and he is the one that is in no need of anything or in anyone. He was not born, and he did not give birth either, and there is none like him. And I mean, if you read this short surah, I mean, it's pretty understandable. But if you look even, you know, deep down in the context in which it was revealed, it gives a lot more, a lot richer, you know, context that can allow you to, you know, ponder on it even further.
So that would be also something that someone could look up and find an English version of English translation, and it's called Tafsir.
Tafsir, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tafsir.
Right.
And that's a combination of the Quran and the Hadith, some of the interpretation from the prophetic tradition of the Quran.
Right.
Caller, anything else?
No, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for the questions. It led to some very good responses.
Yeah, thank you.
Let me give the numbers again for others who'd like to call. If it's a long-distance call, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. We'll put you in the studio here at WILL in Urbana. If it's a local call, 333-9455. So 333-WILL will reach several local lines. Our guests again are representatives of the Islamic faith from the Intercultural Friendship Foundation, a organization, a student organization here at the University of Illinois. And we have one postdoctorate fellow, Melikan Tanyari, who is in physics, and one graduate student, Aziz Yuldashev, who is in studying English as a second language. Aziz is from Uzbekistan and originally, and Melikan is from Turkey. Melikan, let me follow up something with you that you were mentioning earlier. There are these four sources of knowledge in Islam. I had mentioned that sometimes some people have thought within even the Quran there are different ideas that may be contradictory. Within these four sources, if there's different interpretations, how does a Muslim decide what to do or what to believe?
The answer is in actually in both ways. It actually has two aspects. So one of them is in terms of faith-based, you know, belief-based, basically what are the faith concepts, and the other one is in actions. So in terms of actions, for example, how one prays, how one fasts, for example, how one does charity in Islam. So what has developed in time after the death of the Prophet Muhammad is that there were great scholars, especially during the first and the second century after the death of Prophet Muhammad. And those scholars basically interpreted the actions of the Prophet in a systematic way. And schools of thought has built from those scholars' way of thinking. For example, in terms of actions, for example, you know, rules and regulations of prayer and daily life, there are basically four thoughts, schools of thought that has developed out of it. And then there are also a couple of belief, you know, schools that has developed from in time. There are basically two schools of belief. For example, what I mean by that is, for example, the concept of God, or the, you know, the role of prophet, for example, so, or, you know, what would the be the hereafter would be like, or you know, the names of the God, about the names, the understanding of the names of the God, you know, about the infinite power, about eternity of God. So for example, for I would give an example for the for the action. So four schools of thought has been developed, and I for example chose the Hanafi, which is called the Hanafi school. And what people do is, if they're born Muslim, depending on the geographical location, for example, most of the Turks are Hanafis. So they basically follow that school of thought, and they...
How is that word spelled?
Hanafi is like H-A-N-E-F-I, Hanafi. It could be spelled. You know, okay. So it basically puts it. You know, you don't have to follow these schools of thoughts, but it would be very hard for us for an individual to read the Quran and read the Hadith and get an understanding of what to do. So it's basically has been already put by these excellent scholars in history.
All right, so let me make a comparison and see if this is apt or not. It may not be, but in Catholic Christianity, mm-hmm. there's a pope.
Okay.
There, when the pope speaks ex cathedra, from the chair, from the throne, it's an authoritative interpretation that all Catholics are exposed to accept. Now, we know not all do all the time, but is that what this is in Islam?
Not exactly.
Okay.
So this is not a pope would a khalifa would be identical to pope in Islam, maybe, if you do a comparison. But these schools of thoughts are completely different.
Okay.
It's not like, you know, putting new rules into the... It's just an interpretation of how Prophet Muhammad lived and how you can regulate your daily life accordingly now, for example.
But in some parts of Islam, if I understand it correctly, and I'm not an expert at all, but as I understand it, in some parts of Islam, there are no clergy. There are no sort of religious leaders who are people that one might go to for an interpretation. In other parts of Islam, there are imams, there are, mm-hmm. as you say, caliphates,
mm-hmm.
There are ayatollahs who seem to have authority in some cases. Now, you're smiling at that. Why is that?
Well, because, there's no divine authority after Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So nobody can claim, you know, himself or herself as the divine authority.
So there's no, and again, I apologize for using Christian examples, but there's nothing like in Christianity that some churches, like the Episcopal Church or the Catholic Church, where there's this tradition of the authority that's been handed on to the bishops from one bishop to the next bishop and that sort of thing.
I would say no.
No. Okay. Thank you. We're about halfway through our program. I want to thank our guests for being here, talking about Islam. And we're going to talk about a specific program that IFF has in terms of neighbors. Tell us what this is. What are you trying to encourage people to do? It's called Invite Your Neighbor to Dinner.
Yeah, that's right. It's called Invite Your Neighbor to Dinner, and it's a program basically that was inspired by one of the dinners that we organized, Ramadan dinners, and the idea is to basically get people to know each other better and learn a lot more things about each other, and perhaps discover things that they never realized exist about each other, which does not really concern only religion, but, you know, a lot of cultural aspects.
Sure.
And a lot of, well, in this relation, a lot of traditions that are connected with eating and, I don't know, perhaps some dietary restrictions that sometimes can be, you know, that are really interesting to a lot of people. And basically, it's just a program that will help us be better neighbors, hopefully. And so what we are trying to do is to get people who would like to be hosts and people who would like to be guests, and hopefully people who would like to be both, and then kind of match hosts with the guests from various faith traditions and cultures, and then organize it in such a way that they would visit each other and have dinner.
In people's homes or in restaurants, or could it be either?
It could be either, preferably at homes.
Okay. You like the idea of being in one another's homes.
Right? Yeah. So the basic idea is to basically have our local community to invite people from different faith traditions to their home and build friendships.
And let's just say quickly how people who are interested in this can do it. If you have a pencil and paper, a way to take a note somehow on your electronic device, you can Google IFF and then UIUC. And this is what will come up, IFF, and then you look at invite your neighbor to dinner, and you can see how you can register to be either a guest or a host. Or if you want to go to the website directly, it's uiuc.edu/ro/IFF. But you can Google IFF and UIUC and then look for invite your neighbor to dinner.
Mm-hmm. We have an application in the PDF form. They can download it and either send us by email. Our email address is iff@uiuc.edu.
Yes.
Or they can simply mail it to us, and our P.O. Box address is at our website.
Great. Now, you're hoping people will host a dinner. How many guests might they have?
It depends on the basically host, because we are also asking them how many people they can accommodate.
Right. So it could be one, two,
up to
10, 12?
Yeah. 100? Yeah.
Probably not 100.
I've been fortunate to have been a guest in several Muslim homes, both in this country and abroad. And I'll encourage people who've not had that privilege that you'll find some wonderful food. And some wonderful conversations. And the same kind of informal talk that we can do here in the studio, you can do over your table, and you can ask your questions and not have to depend on me to ask things that I should have but overlooked. So I do encourage people to participate in this very creative and I think very helpful program, Invite Your Neighbor to Dinner. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith radio shows on Sunday nights from 5 to 6 here on WILL, a radio service of the College of Media here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We are supported. This radio station is supported by listeners, of course, and we do have several opportunities for listeners to make contributions to WILL to keep all kinds of programs coming your way on both AM, FM, and television. So I encourage listeners to remember WILL as you think of your charitable contributions. Coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead, next week on the 23rd of March, Mike Polito will be our guest, who's president of Red Bison. And that unusual name is for a group who's very much interested in restoring and protecting Illinois prairies, the kind of land that was here before some of the latest groups of settlers and farmers came 150 years or so ago. And we'll have some interesting discussions next Sunday with Mike Polito. Coming up in April, Josh Slocum will be one of our guests from the He's the National Executive Director of the Funeral Consumers Association. If you've ever wondered about end-of-life issues, Josh Slocum will have a lot of interesting ideas for you to consider as you think about making plans for the end of life, which after all comes to all of us, no matter what our religious faith. On later in April, on the 27th, we'll have a fascinating panel here on the radio with Buddhists and Jewish rabbis and Christian educators and pastors talking about a specific novella, The Death of Ivan Ilyich, or The Death of Ivan Ilyich, by Lev Tolstoy, Leo Tolstoy. It's a very small novel. It's available in English at the libraries. There are copies you can get free by going by the University YMCA, as well as study guides. And we're encouraging people throughout this community from many different traditions to read this fascinating book by this Russian wonderful writer about someone who is living an interesting, successful life and suddenly became very ill. And as he approached death, reevaluated some of his choices and decisions. So it's a great book to read if you've not read it. It's worth reading again if you have already, and be prepared for several ways to talk about that in this community. And one way is on the radio on April 27th. I noticed in the Daily Illini, oh, and I might just mention that the University YMCA, where I'm the director, is not having a Friday forum this week, not having a Know Your University Tuesday noon lecture because of spring break. So we'll be getting back to those the following week. I noticed in the Daily Illini this Tuesday, there was a wonderful front page article about the Interreligious Dialogue Series that IFF has been sponsoring in town. You've had three of these four sessions, and the last one is April 3rd on a Thursday night at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Green Street in Urbana. And there the discussion is going to be about the problem of evil in different religions. How do different religious traditions explain the fact that there is evil in the world if there is a good Allah, if there is a good God, a good divine being? You've already had three sessions. What is God? What are the sources of the faiths for different traditions? And what about sharing one's faith? That was the most recent one you just had that this front page article was about.
Yep.
You were both in attendance. What did you think about that?
I think this session was a very nice development after the first two. And we got some really interesting insights about the ways people share their faith and about how people are expected to share their faith in different religious traditions, which, again, offered the opportunity to see how many similarities we have in a way we should, address, not only ourselves and how we believe in our religious traditions, but also how we behave towards others and how our belief in religious traditions reflects in the way we behave and how we approach others with this knowledge. So I think it was really interesting, and unfortunately, I wasn't able to really concentrate on what every single speaker was saying because I was one of them. it was an amazing experience, and it was great to be part of it. And I'm really, really looking forward to the next session too.
Now, Dr. Tenier, you were able to sit back and just listen. You weren't on the panel. What was your impression?
Well, there are eight panelists. So Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, Mennonite, Presbyterian, Unitarian Universalist, Muslim, and Catholic. And it gives you a great perspective of religion, how each religion approaches, like the first three sessions were about the basic concepts of religions, and the last session being proselytizing and sharing one's faith. It was quite interesting for example, the Buddhist Hindu speaker talked about how Hinduism, being rather than tolerant, being, you know, having the virtue of acceptance rather than tolerance towards other religions, you know, just accept them as, you know, as every human being with their religion as they are. And the Catholic speaker was a recent convert to Catholicism, and he briefly mentioned about how to become a Catholic, and that was also interesting. And the other speakers pretty much talked about, you know, how one embraces their faith, or how each religion looks at the proselytizing, you know, the concept of proselytizing. So it was quite interesting.
Now, I noticed you didn't have some of the more very right-wing Protestant evangelicals represented on the panel. I suppose that's because everybody knows how they evangelize, because they've had their door knocked on, or they've had someone come up and say, "Are you a Christian?" or "Are you saved?" or those kinds of things.
We actually didn't intend to, you know, exclude any, any of the, you know, traditions. But we had to kind of limit the number of Christian, you know, representatives on the panel. So we have currently four.
Okay.
And so
that seems plenty. So why are you, as Muslim graduate students, as a postdoctorate in your case, Malakhan, your lives are so full, you have so many pressures on you, you're in a foreign country, you're working in a foreign language, you're far from your families. Why do you take time to do things like set up these dialogue series and go to all the difficulties of finding panelists and advertising it and encouraging people to join this Invite Your Neighbor to Dinner project? Why do you do all that in addition to your main focus professionally?
Personally, I find it quite important, you know, when I think about my faith, especially after September 11th, that, you know, recent couple of decades, the, you know, Muslims have not been considered as, you know, nice or good neighbors in the Western world, and also in the world in general. So I find myself responsible, or I you know, personally feel myself obligated to basically go and reach out to the people in the community and talk about these issues and try to go through these, you know, just tear down some of the stereotypes. And I'm just a single person. How much can I achieve, you can ask? But that's basically, I find myself obligated to do at least what I can do on my, portion. And I've found IFF, the organization that I volunteer for, is doing a good job, a decent job on campus in doing that. And I try to help in my spare time, you know,
Aziz, what about you? Do you find any reason for doing this in the Quran, in the prophetic tradition?
I think we could find dozens of traditions for doing what we're doing. I don't want to sound I don't want to show off by saying that probably we would not have time in this program to talk about all these reasons. I could say that there are indeed plenty of reasons to do that, and it's not simply something that one may feel comfortable doing, but something that one should feel, and that we believe one should feel obligated to do. And of course, I mean, sometimes I feel really bad that I'm not able to contribute as much as I could have or should have. But one of the reasons that I can think of is, for example, is in the very basic concept of being thankful for something, because in Islam, if you think of the concept of being thankful, one of the interpretations that you eventually can reach at is that being thankful means to use the things that have been given to you in ways that would not lead to evil things or evil deeds. And if we look at when I look at my situation and the fact that I've been granted this opportunity to study here at the University of Illinois and learn about the latest theories and second language acquisition and the latest practices and teaching English as a second language, I find this something that I am and should be immensely thankful for. And one of the ways that I think I can express my gratitude to God is by using this opportunity, by using the opportunity of being here to do things that would create the opportunities for people to learn about Islam and to learn that it's a religion that encourages people to do good deeds and encourages them to be good neighbors too.
We have a caller who wants to join the conversation. Others may call us at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Line number one, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Were you the individuals that, I don't know whether it was 2-3 years ago, that showed the Muhammad film? Is that correct or not?
Yeah, that's probably us.
Okay, it was, I'm a Christian, and I found it very enlightening. I think everyone, given that opportunity, should see that. I thought it was sort of cute because then, I think it was over in the engineering campus or some or other, and I thought it was cute that in terms of then we had pizza.
Now, what was it about the film on Muhammad that particularly struck you?
Well, it's been a while, you know, and I was listening to your conversation, and it just, you know, his whole life, I mean, just in the changes in life, and I just, you know, again, just think that, in fact, I would actually like to see it again. I don't, are you showing it again, or has it been a while, or not?
We have actually just recently showed it again. I think when you saw it was probably after the unfortunate cartoon controversy about
Denmark.
And we decided to show it on campus to raise some understanding about Prophet Muhammad, basically.
And where did you show it most recently?
It was also in the engineering campus, Digital Computer Lab.
Is the film available on DVD?
Yes, it
What's
is.
What's it called?
It's Muhammad, Legacy of a Prophet, and it's a PBS documentary. You can get it through Amazon or PBS.
But I think maybe where I was impacted was his change in later life, you know, the beginning and at the end. But like I said, it's been such a while that, you know, but it was very well done.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful documentary about the life of Prophet Muhammad. I enjoy it myself very much. And the nice thing about that is it relates to the Muslims in America. So they chose some characters living in United States and how September 11th changed their lives, and then going back and forth between the life of Prophet Muhammad and how his life has affected the Muslims in United States. So it's a very well-done documentary.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for the call.
And, of course, it's no surprise that it would be a PBS documentary.
Yeah.
We know the high quality of things done on the public broadcast system. We have another caller on line number two. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Yes, line two.
Hello.
Hello.
The program so far, the gentlemen seem to be, frankly, on another planet. I mean, everything that we read in the media is about violence. Every day we're hearing hundreds practically of people being killed or wounded, sectarian violence, you know, and to talk about, you know, people wanting to meet Muslims and to have dinner with them and so on, I mean, that's a little bit, frankly, it strikes me as bizarre. I mean, one of your people alluded to it briefly, but I wondered if they could, the gentleman could comment on this. You know, we're living in a very violent times, and you know, I think they're going way off on a deep end and forgetting about actuality. I mean,
now, are you only talking about violence done by Muslims, or are you also talking about violence done by Christians?
So the problem was, actually, it is. It seems to be Muslims. I mean, in these countries, most of the people who are there are Muslims, like in Iraq. And obviously, most of the suffering, the deaths, and all the wounded people, they are actually other Muslims. So, you know, it just seems a little bit, that they are completely isolating themselves from all these problems that don't seem to abate at all. This violence is continuous. I mean, it's...
Response from our guests?
Yeah, I would like to say that any violence going on either in Iraq or Palestine hurts me deeply. So in that sense, I can relate to how you feel that, you know, we're from another planet or something, that we don't see those problems. No, we do see those problems, and we are we feel really bad about the violence and the going on in that region of the world or in any other region of the world. So basically, what our mission as IFF is, at least to show our local community that Muslims are not violent as they seem to be on the media. So we encourage people to meet, maybe you already know some Muslims from your workplace, but you don't get to know them. So at least by getting to know a Muslim person, maybe how you perceive Muslims may change it at least. So our what the programs that we put out is to is basically, you know, to build bridges and, you know, raise an understanding of basically a mutual understanding of Islam and between Islam and Christianity and Islam and any other religion, Judaism or any other religion in our community. So we do our we spend our efforts in basically doing reversing that negative image which is scratched into people's memories. And do it by small steps that we take at a time.
I guess I would just add to this a little bit and say that it's that I think, and I'm sure Malik Khan would agree with me, that it's really unfortunate that the nature of the work that most of mass media sources do, unfortunately, is turning the attention of a lot of people from the peaceful life that the majority of Muslims in the world are leading, and from all those denunciations and rejections of those horrible acts by a lot of Islamic organizations and Muslim groups, and turning them to all the violence that's being done in several particular parts of the world, which hurts not only Malik Khan and me, but a lot of Muslims too. I mean, I would just say that actually IFF was founded partly as a result of 9/11. You know, it was right after 9/11 that IFF was founded, and And the purpose of all our programs is to raise this cross-cultural understanding and raise the cross-religious understanding to let people know about what the true message of Islam is, and what and that it's not just something that that individuals do in certain parts of the world, but something that majority of Muslims adhere to and believe in.
Let me thank the caller for the good question. As a Christian, I can't help but comment that there were just under 3,000 people killed at 9/11, and the very small Muslim group that caused that to happen, most of them came from Saudi Arabia, which is a country that's in very, very friendly terms with the U.S., and the U.S. is a very high percentage of Christians. I can't give you the exact number, but if you look at the number of deaths since 9/11, by far, the most people killed were killed because of military actions of the Christian country, the United States of America, which I also deeply regret, just as you regret violence done by other Muslims. I deeply regret violence done by other Christians. We're toward the very end of our program. Let me just mention one thing in the news in regard to Islam, and that is one of the presidential candidates, Barack Obama, has been called the M-word. The M-word has been used. Oh, he's not a Christian like he says he is. He's a Muslim. How does that make Muslims feel in this country, when sort of the worst thing that opponents to one of our presidential candidates can say is, he's a Muslim?
Yeah, I think that basically comes from his middle name. I think his middle name is Hussein. Yes. So I'm not into politics at all, and I don't like to talk about politics. But what I think is, I mean, he just says he's a member of the United Church of Christ.
That's
and
in Chicago.
Yeah, so he says he's a Christian, and that's fine with me. And I think his father was a Muslim.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I don't know how that has anything to do with his politics or not. I think the important thing is to look at his actions rather than his lineage.
I'm afraid we'll have to stop there. We are out of time. I do want to thank all of our callers and our two guests from the Intercultural Friendship Foundation, IFF. And if you listeners would like to join in the dinner project to be a guest or a host or both, do Google IFF and then put in UIUC, and the website will come up and look for Invite Your Neighbor to Dinner. UIUC.edu/RO/IFF will also reach the website. Encourage people to also come to the April 3rd dialogue at the Unitarian Church at 7 p.m. on the problem of evil. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the director of the University YMCA. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Things go better with biting the wax tadpole? That doesn't sound right. Yet that's the literal translation of Coca-Cola that Chinese shopkeepers came up with. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, we'll explore the exotic world of foreign languages. We'll hear the confessions of a language fanatic. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7, here on WILL Urbana. A flood watch is in effect for Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Logan, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, Shelby, and Vermilion counties from Monday afternoon through Wednesday morning. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a low in the lower 30s and east winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, showers likely and a chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon. The high 52 with southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour and gusting.
WILL programs are funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, performing computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake, suspension, preventive maintenance, and other repairs. A shuttle service is also available. More information is available at 344-0800.
It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.